Greetings, everyone, and welcome to Sci-Fi Dig. I am your host, Aaron Makeham. This week, I'm going to discuss the film from 1992 called Split Second. And this was our Rutger Hauer vehicle. And, you know, it was during a very odd time, I feel, in the 90s, where, you know, in the early, I would say early to mid 90s, I don't think it extended too far into the late 90s, where we didn't have a lot of science fiction franchise coming up. You know, it was, I think if you look back on the decades and what was happening, it was kind of like a flat spot when it comes to big multi-movie kind of deals or movies that made such a big splash in the science fiction world that, that made huge amounts of money, but it was also like really like ingrained in your brain. With that being said, it was a great time because you had a whole lot of smaller sci-fi movies as everybody was kind of trying to find their way. I mean, you had Star Trek that was on its way out. You know, we were, you know, in the movie franchise, you know, we were, you know, working, the last film had just come out. And or was just going to come out. The reason I know that is because Kim Cattrall stars in Split Second, and you can see where she's still growing her hair out from her role in the Undiscovered Country. So, you know, you didn't really have any kind of big franchises coming in and saying, okay, we're going to make multiple movies. Of course, you know, part of that back then, you didn't have, you know, a lot of it's press now, but you did not have all this information available. You didn't have studios planning multiple films right ahead and pushing forward for shooting multiple films at one time, you know, the original one in the sequel, or, you know, the second one, the third one together or whatever. And if those plans were out there, we really didn't know about them. So you didn't really have the buzz about the whole thing. You didn't have people saying, man, I got to go see the first one because they're already working on a two or a three. So, it's just kind of the box office was kind of flattened out. You know, home video had really taken a hold at this point in time. You know, it was at the point where you can go to the store and buy VHSs of, you know, your favorite movie or whatever. There was, we were also entering the bargain bin era, where there was a lot of films that were relatively inexpensive. You know, you had the thing about VHS at the time was that you had they were taking and putting it in long play mode and putting the movie on like that. So the quality wasn't quite as good, but you were able to sell a movie for like $8. And so this stuff was really all taking off. So you had a lot of stuff out there. You had a lot of direct-to-video stuff, which, you know, now, you know, people are just like, it's direct-to-video. But you have to remember, like, in this time frame, in the early 90s, early to mid-90s, you had these, a lot of really good films that were going direct-to-video. And you had a lot of press around that, where you'd have, like, some of the actors going to video stores and promoting these films and getting them to buy multiple copies. And, you know, I don't know. I mean, were they making as much money as if they did a big theatrical release? I don't know. Was it probably less overhead cost and more opportunity for these actors to meet one-on-one with a lot of their fans who would then, you know, keep buying their movies and help support the actor over the years, you know, either with, you know, purchases or, you know, just talking them up, getting other people to view the films. I mean, Tim Thomerson was one of the people that, you know, comes to mind with what they really had to do for a lot of the films that he did at the time. You know, we had Trancers and Doll Man and stuff like that was coming out. And there was a lot of, they did a lot of personal appearances and smaller venues in order to promote these movies. And so I always kind of look back on this time as, even though things were kind of, we didn't have the big blockbusters, you didn't have the big names. It was like, it seemed as though to me, like a lot of the sci-fi, the genre itself, I don't want to say it was dying because that's not a fair assessment, but it was just really kind of low key. You know, there wasn't a whole lot of big things happening. There's a lot of stuff out there, but not a lot of big things happening. But I really enjoyed this. I thought this was more, for me, this was more of like a golden age of sci-fi because there were so many things being thrown against the wall and tried out to see what would work. And they were trying with so many different budgets. And it was at this point, you know, as we head, you know, into the mid 90s to the late 90s, that everybody started to realize, hey, you know, if we're going to make science fiction television, we don't have to have everything set on a spaceship in space like Star Trek. We can have that genre and not have, you know, we can branch out into supernatural. We could branch out into, you know, science fiction with a little bit more hard science behind it. We don't have to have people in the future on a spaceship with ray guns. You know, we can do other things. And to me, this is what made science fiction great, because we had, you know, we had like the X-Files come out. We had the Burning Zone. We had a lot of these things that were taking place in, right now in our current time. And they just had the science fiction kind of slant to them that really made it work. And it also, you got to think that one of the big things that happened with something like the X-Files is you had not just science fiction geeks, you know, watching this, but you had people who like procedurals who were watching this, conspiracy, that, you know, they had this whole conspiracy thing, you know, genre going on. All these things, you know, for this one show, you brought in other fans, and then they went and saw other things, et cetera, et cetera. So it was, to me, it was a real, like, you know, golden age. You know, I want to call it a golden age, not as in, you know, it was a long time ago, but a golden age as in there was just so much diversity and what people were doing with films and, you know, DVD and VHS and, you know, all these things that were coming. I mean, Laserdisc was really big, right? You know, they doing these really crisp and clean as much as they could, you know, Laserdisc films. And you know, it was a great time in entertainment if you were a fan of the genre, because if, you know, since they weren't pushing out a lot of movies, but the home video market was booming. Everything was just kind of like all the things that we like today were coming out. I mean, we like our Criterion Collection, our Blu-rays, and our special editions, you know, of films that we've loved. And, you know, this is just kind of like the start of that. You know, first you get a VHS copy, then you know, they go back and do a Laserdisc copy. They try to do it pristine with a decent audio and, you know, great video, maybe some extra scenes, throw in some director's cut, you know, type stuff. You know, and then, you know, we moved on toward DVD, where now it's just like if we love a film, we're kind of gobbling up everything that they put out there. You know, I know there's people out there that have like 10 different versions of any given movie that they really love, because every time they add a little extra, and the only way to get that is to buy the film again. You know, so they knew how to make the money. They knew what the fans wanted. And so we had that going on. But, you know, in the midst of all this, you know, we also had this great boom of the locally owned video store. This was something that I personally loved. There wasn't a big video store really anywhere close to me. The closest one was probably 30 minutes away. So there was a locally owned one. There was two of them, but one of them was actually pretty good. And I loved the store because, you know, you would go in and they had all the new releases, and there was all this stuff that, like, you know, that you didn't see advertised or anything. And so you'd go and you try it out. Maybe it was good, maybe it wasn't, but it was just kind of a fun time to go and peruse these films and take a chance on them. Split Second was one of those movies for me. Now, you know, what I also liked about the video store, and I remember this was just such a big deal back then, is that if you remember, you know, like the big movies had come out, and when Batman came out on VHS, that was the first movie that they put out at $25, and they sold like freaking gangbusters because everybody wanted a copy of Batman. It was so big. Up until then, they were $90 a piece, and so nobody really bought VHSs. You just went and rented them. So at my local video store, like once every 6 months, they would have a sale where they would go through all their used stuff, and they would keep like a copy, but then they would sell off the extra copies because they would buy multiple copies to get people in the store. And it was such a big deal. I remember it would be in the morning and they would open and the place would be packed. And this place wasn't that big to begin with, but I mean, I would go in to buy like my favorite films. I mean, I think about my first copy of Terminator 2 like that. You know, I went in and I was so excited to be able to get it for like $15. You know, even if it was used, I didn't care. You know, and I've came across a lot of really good movies like that that, you know, otherwise I wouldn't have been able to afford, and was able to do that because of the sale. But it was such a great time to be a fan of films in general. But if you love science fiction, this was the time, because these smaller movies, either they were going straight to DVD or had a very limited screening. Straight to VHS rather, had a very limited screening. This was a time when this was a huge business, and you know they weren't afraid to try something new. They weren't afraid to get some unknown actors. They weren't afraid to make something campy. They weren't afraid to have some crappy effects because you kind of got the idea. You know, they weren't afraid to try a different type of story as opposed to the stories we were normally used to, you know. And so for me, this was a great time. Anyway, with all that being said, I want to go on to talk about Split Second, which is what we're here to talk about. And this was a movie that I got in the video store, and I wasn't sure. What I knew was that I liked Rutger Hauer, and I mean, I've seen him in a lot of different films, and it was something that I really wanted to investigate. It seemed like it was something that that was right up my alley. You know, it had a science fiction kind of horror slant to it. At the same time, it was an action piece. And so I was like, man, I want to go check this out. I really want to see what's going on here. Saw this, rented it, and I remember watching it, and I enjoyed it. It was a decent film. I had a good time with it. And I took it back, and I don't think I've ever given that movie much more of a thought beyond that, which is not to say that the movie didn't, that I don't remember the movie, or that the movie didn't, make a mark on me. It was the fact that it was just kind of like disappeared for a while. And even for this particular show, I had trouble finding a copy of the film in order to do a review. I will say that there are times in the film where the copy I had was not very good, pretty beat up. And I just, and the film is really dark. And as you know, if you're going to get a lot of artifacting and stuff like that, pixelation with a dark film, especially when you have a really crappy version of it. And I wish that, actually, I didn't even look to see if there was a Blu-ray available. I don't think that there is. But at any rate, you know, this is the version that I had. And I decided when I was going to come back and do the podcast and I was going to review some of these films that if it wasn't a film that I was going to watch again, that I wasn't going to bother buying a copy unless it was, even if it was like $5 or $6, actually, because I'm trying to minimize what DVDs I have. I could probably, if I quit my job right now, it would probably take me 5 years to watch everything I have on DVD. That's if I slept like 8 hours a day. I figured that there's not really a point to doing that. And the thing is, it's funny, for a while there, when we wanted to watch a film, because you got to keep in mind that I don't have the best internet here, so streaming, it's better now, but streaming for a while was not really an option. If I wanted to see a movie, I had to buy it or rent it. Well, as Netflix moved more towards streaming and further away from DVDs, a lot of the things were no longer available on DVD. So if we wanted to see a film, my wife would just go on Amazon and find a used copy for like $3. And we would get it on DVD and be able to watch it, which is great. I mean, it's economical. It's cheaper than buying a streaming version or whatever. But what happens is after about 6 months of that, you realize you have all these DVDs laying around that you're probably never going to watch again. The idea was that, I could buy it for what I could rent it for, or even cheaper. And then what do you do? I try to give them away to people. Sometimes people already have them. I don't want to, force my stuff on somebody else who doesn't want it or has stuff of their own, So, I'm trying to avoid that pitfall all over again doing this. So I have a couple friends who have DVDs who have been kind enough to lend them to me, and knowing that I'll take care of them and then I can give them back. In this case, however, the version of this movie that I had was a digital copy because nothing was to be found anywhere else. And I also have some other friends that have some digital copies of films. I'm lucky enough that, I watch enough movies digitally that I've bought a few things in the past, and then I was lucky enough. I don't even know why I did it. Because there's certain, I got into this rut for a while where I would buy things, and then if I thought I wouldn't have time to watch them, I'd rip them, and so I'd put them on a mobile device. Half the time, about 90% of the time, never watched them, just kind of accumulated on a hard drive. It actually turned out to be a good thing is when I got a new dog, the dog decided that DVDs tasted really, really good. And she managed to get in and eat about 10 of them that I had already ripped. So no longer have those, but at least I have the digital file. So thank God for that. But anyway, kind of getting off topic here. So the idea here, and this is something else I liked about Split Second, is that it takes place in the future, and it is, it's in London, and the water level, the seas are rising everywhere. So there's water all over London, like in the streets and stuff like that. There's always people trying. It's like nothing now. It's like you see these cops and stuff coming out of the building, and they have to walk through this water that's like 6 inches deep. Doesn't even faze them. It's all part of the life that they live. And that was the first thing that I saw that I thought was kind of interesting. When I was watching the film, I was like, oh, that's kind of neat. It's a little bit different, you know. Now, there's some problems with the film. There's things that did not really, I felt, could have been more developed. But for what this film was, which is basically kind of like a horror sci-fi serial killer kind of thing going on, I guess we didn't really need that. I guess part of it, as I get older and I watch these films, I'm like, well, what about this? What about that? Why did this happen? Why did that happen? You know, and I want to know more details about what, you know, where this creature comes from, because we think it's a man. You know, I'm not quite sure what is going, I mean, although the box tells you it's some sort of creature, but they don't really set that up in the film until, like, I don't know, about 15 or 20 minutes in, then you realize that you don't ever see it until the end, but you realize it cannot be a human. It has to be some sort of creature or monster that's doing the killing. And we're not quite sure why. Rucker Hauer and his partner were chasing it at one point, and his partner ends up getting killed by the creature, and he is kind of haunted by that. Now, before I give away too much, I have my first audio clip here. I'm going to set this up a little bit. Right at the beginning, Rucker Hauer goes in this bar, and he, you know, he has a very big gun, and he's kind of hanging out. And this young lady goes to the bathroom and asks if he'll watch the door, and he says, yeah. Well, while she's in the bathroom, she starts to scream. He runs in. She's dead. Her chest is tore open, and there's blood everywhere. And he realizes that this killer is back. It's the same MO. So he goes out, and he's running through the bar trying to figure out where he's at. And he's kind of going crazy and trying to find it. And so they end up putting him in – I think they end up locking him up, you know, because he's kind of going nuts. So this clip is the chief of police and the guy who's going to be his new partner having a conversation on their way to the police station. And this is what happens.
And what? He started raving like a lunatic, totally out of control. It took 4 officers to subdue him.
Where is he now?
Lock up. What happened to him?
A serial killer murdered his partner, Foster, 3 years ago. He was there when it happened.
Survivor's guilt?
Nah, just plain guilt. Had an affair with Foster's wife. Left her. Hit the booze. Went over the edge. Now he lives on anxiety, coffee and chocolate.
If you ask me, he's nuts.
That's what the doctors say. Here, read the file. He's worked in every hellhole in the world and been fired from all of them.
They say he's the best.
He is.
I followed him down an alleyway. He shot a trash can.
Sounds like Stone. Well, maybe you'll be a soothing influence.
Pardon me?
He's your new partner.
Man, you gotta love the 80s and 90s with these cool names like Stone. So anyway, this new guy is one of these, you know, kind of smart fellas that, you know, real book. It's a typical setup. You got like the gut feeling, man of action kind of guy. Then you have the book guy who they're learning off of one another. And the by the book guy, you know, is kind of getting on Stone's nerves, following him around and seeing, you know, they've been following for a while. They don't really explain why he's been following him, what's been going on. But for whatever reason, you know, he's been being followed, and he doesn't come across as Rucker Hauer doesn't play the character as somebody who's becoming unhinged. Rather, he plays the character as somebody who's just really angry all the time. He's just angry about everything all the time. He's not, there's another cop in the precinct who's always giving him crap, and they have several altercations, with each other. And you know, everybody thinks that that he's still drinking. Everybody thinks that, you know, he's crazy. Everybody thinks that, you know, he has no idea what he's doing. And for whatever reason, he's being given special treatment. And that's why he's still in the force. Now, this next clip is kind of a meetup of the three. And we find out a little bit more background story about Stone and like how he kind of lives about his life. He definitely likes guns. And it comes from the fact that he had a run-in with this character, you know, and he was not able to win, you know, and so he just figures as much firepower as humanly possible. The precinct is kind of like a busy place, but not doesn't seem very cop-like. Again, you know, they kind of take a lot of liberties with what the future would look like. Of course, this future, I believe it's 2008, so we've done past that. But he realizes that, you know, that the killer is back, because when he examines the woman's body who got killed, you know, it's the exact same MO. Her heart's missing, and her, you know, body cavity has been ripped open. The makeup on this is very well done for the several scenes we have of the gore. And there's several scenes where people have scars that they did a really good job in. You know, it just, the scars look very lifelike, you know, like it would, you know, it's been scarred and healed over or whatever. And they've done a very good job showing all this. And, you know, although I don't feel as though the movie was particularly gory, they are liberal with the blood. When there's a dead body, there's just blood everywhere, showing that this thing is very visceral. And that's kind of how, you know, when you see the first murder and the blood splatter and how fast it happened, you kind of know that this is not just a regular person doing this. There's no way they can do it that quickly or make that big of a mess. You know, it definitely looks something more visceral, like somebody plunged their hand in their chest and ripped it out, and that sort of thing. Anyway, here's the clip.
Killer's back.
I thought you said this guy wouldn't be back.
Sir, all the evidence and research shows that a serial killer of this type doesn't come back.
Who is this?
Detective Dick Durkin.
Are you sure it's him?
He ripped her heart out.
Her heart? What for?
Maybe he eats him for breakfast.
This wasn't in the police reports or the newspapers.
And it's never gonna be. You got that?
Jesus. If they get wind of this, they'll have a field day.
This changes things. I thought we were dealing with a psychotic, not a psychopath. And with such incredible strength, he must be under extreme mental distress or on some kind of stimulant.
Who is this?
I'm curious. How did you know he was going to strike at that club last night?
I didn't.
But you were there before he struck.
So?
That's an incredible coincidence.
Do you know what this is? It's a medical report on you. The doctors say you have anxiety neurosis to the point of being paranoid.
Doctors don't know shit.
How many weapons are you carrying besides this cannon?
An MP-15.
What else?
A Glock 50.
And?
An A3 assault shotgun.
If that's not paranoid, I don't know what the fuck is. I'm surprised you don't have a grenade launcher.
Couldn't get a permit.
This isn't funny!
I just want to be ready.
Ready for what? You can't even find the bastard, let alone shoot him.
I can find him.
Look, if you know so much about this fella, how come we've got a corpse with a heart ripped out? And you're up alleyways shooting at water rats.
Have you been following me?
Damn right he has. Paranoid people with guns are a menace to society.
You'd be paranoid too if you had a dipshit like this following you.
This dipshit happens to be an expert on serial killers.
If he's such an expert, what the fuck is he following me for?
I guess I should have prefaced that by reminding everybody salty language. Anyway, so, you know, these two are not, you know, I don't know. I feel as though, like, so I watched this twice. The first time I watched it, I felt as though I did not love the film, as I don't remember. I mean, it's one of those movies that you watch and it's like, man, that wasn't groundbreaking. You remember it as being a fun time. You know, if you're just watching this for the first time and you didn't live through the 90s, then this might not be that great of a movie. It might be something you'd put in the background while you worked on something else, you know. For me, it brought back memories of the, you know, good times the 90s were with these science fiction films and these, and a lot of the direct-to-video stuff and the low-budget films that they put out there. And low-budget doesn't necessarily mean bad. It just means that they were working with less money and they had to come up with a better idea to sell the film. This kind of works on all those levels. There were things about it I did not like, and I felt were kind of just too many of the tropes you normally find in a film. So, you know, what I had to watch it a second time. And on the second time, I realized that Rutger Hauer does put a lot of effort into his relationship with the new guy, because you can see him slowly kind of warming up to him as the film progresses. You know, Rutger Hauer goes to see his girlfriend, who is his partner's, widow. And I don't know, at this point in time, it doesn't seem as though they're still having a relationship, any kind of sexual relationship or romantic entanglement. But clearly, he cares about her a lot, and she cares about him. He comes she's visiting him, and he falls asleep, and she opens up his badge, and her picture's in there. And she's no slouch. I mean, she knows what's going on. She's not so much the damsel in distress kind of thing, you know. But, during this time, Rutger Hauer sees his partner's car outside, and he goes down and messes with him. And we see it's slowly kind of developing. I think part of it is, like I said, Rutger Hauer is just so angry as Stone. He's just an angry, angry man at everybody. And, you know, he's angry about a lot of things, but mostly he's just so the obsession he has isn't like, I don't feel, I think that they use the word obsession a lot of times in films as it seems something that's unhealthy. And I don't necessarily think that's the case here. I think that his obsession is just that this creature, this person, this serial killer has made a very negative impact in his life. And now he's just like, screw it. I got nothing else. I'm going to spend my time until I find this thing and destroy it, because of what it's done. And because nobody else is taking it seriously. His whole thing is that I'm the only one that's taking this thing seriously. I'm the only one that's seen what this thing can do. And I don't want to everybody else is just kind of goofing around, and, this thing needs to be taken out. And so since nobody else is paying attention to it, it's become my job to pay attention to it. And that kind of feeds into that obsession with the creature he has. At any rate, this next clip is kind of mixed up. Because we have two scenes, we're doing these scenes back and forth. So just, I thought that was important. I wasn't going to put it in here because of that. But we have a scene where Stone and his partner are in a tavern, and he's finally asking him his opinion about it. But at the same point in time, we have Stone's girlfriend, who is at her place or at his place, and she's taking a shower. And the idea here is that they think that the serial killer is going to break into the building. You know, clearly when this is happening, you're like, yeah, he's going to come after her for whatever reason. You know, we still don't know what exactly all the reasoning is. But obviously the serial killer knows who Stone is and has been doing things to kind of mess with him. And that's going to be revealed here in a little bit. But so excuse the shower noise in between the conversation, but I thought the conversation was kind of important, because we're going to fall into that trope where he is going to be like, hey, you know, why are you doing this? And, you know, what, you know, you need to, you know, you need to, we're going to see that thing where he becomes more like Rutger Hauer's character. He's going to realize everything's not like clean cut and by the book, that sometimes you have to break the rules in order to do, you know, the greater good. Sometimes you got to get rid of all the red tape.
He shows up every month on the night of the new moon. He kills before midnight in different locations. Then he disappears. We don't have a motive. We don't have a pattern.
Slow down.
The only thing we know for sure is that he's not a vegetarian.
Stone?
Okay, dipshit. Your turn. What do you make of all this? I don't care about your degrees. I don't care about secondhand knowledge. I want to know what you think. You.
Any unit in the area, report of an intruder at 16 Roselle Street.
That's
my place.
And of course, they head there and they have a shootout. And somebody else ends up getting killed that's not Stone's girlfriend. And the creature has, taken another heart. I will mention that Nights in White Satin by the Moody Blues is a theme throughout this film, because not only is it playing in the bar in that scene, but it's also an end credit song as well. And I just thought, I don't know, it's just kind of a weird song for that. And it's also, it's in the credits, it's spelled Nights with a K. And I thought that was kind of funny too, that they misspelled it. Now, you know, this movie did, in fact, open in theaters. Unfortunately, it opened in theaters during the LA riots. So that is one of the reasons that it did not do as well. You know, but I think it really did gangbusters on home video. But, you know, we still never really get those numbers. That's the only thing. But the budget was about $7 million, and the box office gross is only $5.4 million. So that kind of shows you that, you know, it could have done better. But like I said, at this time frame, a lot of these films really took off on home video. And the reason that people know about them is because of home video, because they did not do well at all in the theaters, or they did not make, you know, they didn't make back their money. Of course, now a movie can make, you know, $20 million more than it cost and is considered a bomb, you know, which, I don't know, $20 million is a lot of money to me, but, you know, I don't know. So it's kind of interesting the way things have kind of turned. And of course, you know, movies now, the budgets are way, way more than $7 million, especially for a movie like this. When you look at it and you see $7 million, the money was well spent. You know, the movie does not, I mean, it's got good production values. It's got good acting across the board. Lots of action and stuff like that. Nothing looks cheesy. The creature is fantastic. I just love what they did with the monster, so to speak, in this film. You know, one of the trademark things is the hand with the long nails, and it's just very, very well done what they did with that. It's something that's very simple, but really comes across, has that scare factor. Unfortunately, you know, one of my nitpicks is the fact that they don't show the creature till the end, but you show the shootout. The creature does use weapons. So they have the shootout at this apartment, and they keep focusing in on, you know, its gun. And I'm like, well, you all you see is the muzzle of the gun. But I'm like, with fingers that long, you see at the end of nails that long, there's no way it was shooting a gun. That had to be super duper complicated. Okay, the next audio clip kind of explains the background of the creature. There was a whole lot of like, there was like about 8 minutes of audio explaining it being the year of the rat, because this thing has rat DNA in it. And, you know, why, cause they couldn't figure out why, you know, why it had returned, you know, why it was doing what it was doing. And so this is kind of just part of that. I felt as though they kind of jammed all this together at one point in time, saying, okay, well, this is why it's back, because of this, because it's a year of the rat, you know, the astrological signs. You know, it's got to take a it kills somebody every time there's a full moon, and you know, it kills a victim, it takes its heart, and you know, the idea is that this thing eats its heart, eats the victim's heart, and you know, all, yada yada yada. Then we get into spliced DNA, and they act like this is the thing that they already know. I'm gonna play the clip, and then I'll nitpick about it a little bit.
You know what I just heard? I heard you came face to face with the killer and unloaded a full clip at him. The word is, you missed.
Do you know me to miss?
You're saying you hit him?
I didn't miss, that's what I'm saying.
Then why the fuck isn't he dead?
I unloaded a full clip, 450 Magnum, point blank. He disappeared, vanished in front of me.
You're telling me this guy's superhuman, is that it?
I don't know what he is. Sure as hell ain't like you or me.
What is it?
Genetic fingerprints have come back from the lab. I think you should see this.
What the hell is this?
Multiple restriction polymorphic DNA sequences.
Bullshit.
It has the DNA structure of all its victims.
It says here it's got rat DNA.
Yeah. It's got your DNA too.
Where the hell do you think you're going? Durkin, stick with him.
Yes, sir.
And Durkin.
Sir?
What's your ass?
Multi-polymorphic DNA structure. And they said it like that's something they all knew. And that was like, I'm like, what? Come on. But anyway, they're doing their best to try to explain why it's more than just just some kind of dude serial killing. The whole idea is that he is eating the victim, taking in their DNA, the whole, you know, taking their power, their souls and things like that. And He did, you know, during Stone's partner's attack, Stone also got injured, and so he has DNA in there. And also, he bitten his girlfriend, and therefore it has her DNA as well. So we're coming to the showdown, right? They have to figure out what's going on, you know, what's happening. So they end up coming across the creature. They have another during the battle, and the new guy, he ends up getting injured. We don't know it right away. It was really weird the way they set it up, but ends up carving a symbol in his chest, and they use that to figure out where the creature's at. So they're going to go and track it down.
The world's in chaos.
I don't believe this shit.
He's eating human hearts, for Christ's sake.
How do you know?
We had lunch with him.
Cannibals ate the hearts of their enemies to gain possession of their souls. It obviously believes that if it eats its victims' hearts, it not only gains their power and their DNA, it also gains their souls.
Are you telling me?
There's something running around loose in this city, ripping the hearts out of people and eating them, so they can take their souls back to hell.
Looks that way.
Hallelujah.
You're both fucking nuts!
Salty language. Anyway, so that's kind of like the last like chit chat we have about it. Then we go through this whole phase where what happens is they go and they go to have another during the conversation they realize that the creature is it didn't kill the last victim. So Stone realized that the creature's going to come back because it has to have this victim, so it's going to strike again. So they end up going to you know, I swear that they said it was the morgue, but that doesn't make any sense. But they end up having a battle, and you know, the new guy gets a good eyeful of what this all about. You know, that this thing is crazy, and he shot it a bunch of times, and it didn't phase it. So he's kind of having a little bit of a nervous breakdown. So Rucker Hauer's like giving him coffee and giving him cigarettes, and you know, giving him some chocolate donuts and stuff. And he's slowly turning into a little mini Officer Stone. And or Detective Stone, and so then they go to the gun warehouse, the cops, and they get these, and it's just such a ridiculous thing. They have this what do they call it? Some kind of assault shotgun type thing, fully automatic shotgun. It's supposed to fire like 100 and some rounds a minute. Well, that's not even a thing, and it's just like, it's just ridiculous the weapons they get, but they get all these big weapons, and the new guy just keeps saying, we need bigger guns. So we have this showdown. They you know, use a symbol. They're able to track him down on a map and see what's, you know, find out where he's at, you know. But I mean, of course, it's baiting him, you know. That's the whole thing, is it's trying to bait him and get him to come there so they can have this showdown. He captures his girlfriend. She's sets up like a trap. They end up having a shootout. There's some scenes here that, you know, that are kind of cool, but the last like 5 minutes of this movie, there's so many things that you're just shaking your head at. There is a train car, cause they're like in a subway system, and Rucker Hauer and the creature are having a battle there. And the creature's about ready. Rucker Hauer's down. He's ready to hurt him when the new guy pops open a top and throws, a flashbang grenade in there. And he throws it and tells them to run, and there's a countdown. So the two of them run over, out of the subway car, and Kim Cattrall's there. And Rucker Hauer, he jumps in the water, and he's, like, covering her with his body. And I'm like, well, he's protecting her because there's a countdown for the thing. Well, then they just start making out, which I thought was really freaking weird, that they just started suddenly making out while this explosion goes off. Well, that's over, and the creature, of course, is still alive. And they end up taking some electrical cables and putting them in the water because everything's covered in water, like I said earlier, and turning on the power. And it doesn't kill it, but it slows it down. They're not sure if it's there or not. Well, this is one of the coolest scenes, because you get to see a really good look at the creature. It comes up behind Rucker Hauer. Think of like the alien creature, only more sleek and less like tails and vertebrae and stuff like that. He comes up behind Rucker Hauer and, is behind him. And then they have like a little battle. Rucker Hauer, he takes and plunges his fist into the creature's chest and pulls out the heart. Okay. Which is kind of unbelievable enough because, well, there's a rib cage there, but it's whatever. We're going to roll with it. And then the heart's in his hand, because you keep hearing this beating heart throughout the movie because him and the creature are connected, and that's supposed to be like the connection. It is kind of creepy. But he holds the heart in his hand as it's beating, and then takes his giant gun and shoots it. Well, if he did it, he'd probably blow his damn hand off, but that's not what happens. And then after that, everybody just shoots the creature to bits. And then that's it. You know, the trio start walking away, and we have this little subtle scene of where the creature was laying out in the water, bubbles bubbling. And that could go either way because, I mean, it doesn't have a heart, and they blew it to bits, and they blew the heart to bits. But if they wanted to make a sequel, it's definitely something they could have done at the time. And I'm going to say that maybe this was something that they were setting up, but technically in the 90s, it was about every movie that thought that they could somehow pull a sequel out, set it up so that it could go either way, so that if the movie did well, they could go ahead and do a second one, and we can get more, and, you know, as we know, most sequels, things start to kind of go downhill after a while. But so that's just kind of how it, you know, the film ends. And then we have the Moody Blues, you know, playing over the credits and whatnot. It's a fun film. If you're looking for something different, or if you want to revisit the 90s, this is a good movie to do that, because it was definitely a time where, you know, not only musically, but politically, what the climate was, and that's kind of what brings these films out. It's always exciting for me, I think, for the entertainment industry, when something changes drastically in our lives, that's how the climate changes, whether it's in this country or another country. You know, something changes and kind of the whole world feels it. Entertainment seems to follow, and that's kind of like what was going on here. You had a lot of things happening all at one time. And this is the kind of movies that were coming out at the time. A lot of the future, not necessarily post-apocalyptic, but future where like the rules have kind of changed. They're not what we're used to, type of film. And it's, you have a little bit of a learning curve, and also gives them leniency to do what they want to do with the story and say, yeah, well, you know, this is part of this world. This is just like an everyday thing. You know, like water everywhere is like an everyday thing in this film. You know, so it's just something you kind of take into stride. I give this movie 3 digger shovels out of 5. I didn't, you know, I loved it the time I saw it, but rewatching it now, and this is going to be the thing with these films, as I go back and I revisit them, and, you know, I'm older, and I've had a little more experience, and hopefully a little more wisdom under my belt, my opinions of these films are going to change, because I've changed a little bit, and I can relate a little bit differently than how I used to, so... this one, at the time, it was great because there was so little good science fiction out there, let alone good science fiction movies that had this kind of action. And so I really liked the film at the time, and I still like it. It took a couple of watches. I still enjoy the film. It's just, I think that if somebody new would just sit down and watch this, they would not get the enjoyment out of it that I did. It's definitely tied into the history of what was going on at the time, and my personal history with science fiction and what I liked at the time, and just my personal history in general, you know, depending on what you're going through in your life at the time. But it does have the biggest trope of the whole, the goody two shoes guy slowly becoming more like the angry, you know, cop that breaks all the rules. Those scenes were kind of funny. That guy did a really good job. And you know what? I'm not doing him justice because I don't have, I do not have him up in front of me here on IMDb. He has done a ton, an absolute metric ton of, it's Alistair Duncan. He has done a lot of voice work. I mean, I was just like looking, he's been in a couple things, but he's done for Batman Unlimited. He did the Joker. He's done a ton of video game work as well. So, I mean, obviously, you know, the voice, and he does have a great voice. And when I did that, I paid extra special attention to his voice. He does do a great voice. Kim Cattrall was in here, and, you know, being Kim Cattrall, I mean, she did it. She did a good job. She had some great action scenes, you know. Being Kim Cattrall, she had some nude scenes too, you know. But it was, everybody did, really well. There's a couple scenes where you can really, really, really see the outline of her, Star Trek, previous hairdo. This film shot right after Undiscovered Country, and she was still growing that out, but it's kind of funny. I enjoyed the cinematography of the film, considering everything was so dark. I always feel that when they're shooting things that are that dark, that a lot of times Either we get that crappy blue filter, which I really hate, and you can tell right away that they're trying to turn day into night, or everything is so dark and murky that you don't notice the details you need to notice. The way this worked is there was a lot of scenes where not only is the creature dark colored, but also Rutger Hauer wears a very dark duster, and they did a really good job bringing all that out. Love the guns. Love looking at all the weapons in this movie. They all looked really cool and really the nice cross between conventional and futuristic. So they did a really good job with that. Anyway, Split Second, 1992. If you want just a fun little film to sit down and watch, you want to revisit it, I do recommend it. Like I said, 3 out of 5 for me, and I liked it, but I didn't love it. Not sure what I'm going to do next week. I'm going to go down the list. My schedule's been a little crazy, so I haven't been asking for any co-hosts because I'm not exactly sure how that will play out. I don't want to make any promises I can't keep when it comes to trying to nothing's more irritating than when somebody says like, hey, we're going to record at this time, and somebody rearranges their schedule and then suddenly it falls through. So if I cannot absolutely for certain nail down a time, then I will just continue to solo the podcast. I hope everybody's still enjoying them. Feedback is always appreciated. SciFiDig@gmail.com. You can follow me on Instagram at SciFiDog.com. Although you should be aware that I have this thing on Instagram, and I know that it's probably weird and really like it's just odd is that I run, and when I do, and I come across, I live in a very much rural area, and there's a lot of dead animals that get hit by cars, and so I started taking pictures of them. So if you hashtag roadkill runner, those are all me taking pictures of all the animals I come across that have been run over, and there's a lot of them, and nice variety too. We get some birds, some squirrels, lots and lots and lots and lots of deer, and some various car parts sometimes laying there as well. But anyway, you can follow me on there. I do post a lot of comic stuff, related stuff as well, and I'm thinking about doing a comics only episode. I kind of want to stick to my core audience, which loves movies more, I think, than comics, and there is literally just a glut of comics podcasts out there. And I think, the thing about comics podcasts that I like doing and like listening is that they're easy, first of all, because you can just read the book and then talk about it. But, comics is just a great medium, and there's just so much good stuff coming out. There's been some really good deals recently. So those of you that, I recently had a friend of mine ask me how to get into digital comics because they want to start downsizing with all their paper. And don't get me wrong, I love paper comics, but the more I use digital, it's just so much easier. And since I haven't really had an issue with it, it's really working well for me. But those of you that are interested in getting into digital comics, you know, one of the things you can do is sign up for the Comixology newsletter or sign up for the email list, because they always send you the sales, and there's a lot of good sales, and that's how you kind of get started. You start buying things on sale, and then you kind of accumulate those, and then you can go through and read them. And usually when they have trades and stuff on sale, they're really good deals. There's been some pretty decent deals on some of the Marvel Epic collections coming out, like $10, $9.99 for an Epic collection. It usually runs about 30. So that's a really good deal on that. And the Epic collections, the one thing that I like about them is that they've cleaned it up. They've cleaned up, the pages are white, and they've cleaned things up a little bit. You don't have... So it seems like for a while there, sometimes you were getting these books that they hadn't done any work to, and they were just kind of like really rough looking, you know. So they do a really good job with those. But I've been, when those pop up, I think the Epic collections are really well done. If you don't know what that is, basically what Marvel has been doing is, rather than trading everything together, like say you have the first 20 issues, rather than putting issues 1 through 20 in a book and putting it out, they have been putting a story in a book. And so, and Epic collections are usually like around 400 to 500 pages. So they take an arc, and sometimes there's multiple arcs, but they tie together, and there's other issues that not in that title that ties into what's going on. And they put it together so that you can read it like in chronologically, the story chronologically, not necessarily, getting issues in chronological order. And, it's something that it's a different, I like it because it kind of breaks that collector mentality where you have to have every issue of everything. And like you might collect the first 20 issues of a story. There might be 15 of them that tie into the story, and there might be a couple other ones that are pretty decent. And there might be some real clunkers in there that don't really, they kind of break it up. So they're doing a good job with that. You know, I've only read one of them so far, but I really like the flow of it. It works really well. But for $10, man, Amazon also has a lot of the Epic collections digitally for Kindle. And if you have a Comixology account, you can also read it on your Comixology app as well, if you have your Amazon and Comixology apps connected like I do, which is nice, but it's also kind of a pain in the butt. And I'll tell you why it's a pain in the butt. Because before Comixology, I could have an account and not have a credit card on file. And if I wanted to share my account with somebody, I could. Now, I know some people might think that's unethical, but let me tell you something. If I go buy a comic book at the store and it's a paper comic book, I can give that book to whoever I want to give it to. And they can pass that around for months on end before they give it back to me. So if I do a Comixology account and I don't have my Amazon account tied to it, then I can give that password and username to somebody else. No harm, no foul of getting any kind of financial information, and they can read the books. But I made the mistake of combining them, and I didn't do it on purpose. I was not paying attention, and my fault, and I pushed the wrong button, and I ended up combining them together, and I've regretted it every day since. Because actually, if you buy your comics on Kindle, on Amazon, and you use the Kindle app, you have the same frame-by-frame thing that you have in Comixology, which is one of the benefits of Comixology. Anyway, talking too much. I will talk to everybody next week. Until then, over and out.